This is also a briefing and a public hearing. Mountain goat, big sheep, bighorn sheep, and moose permits and regulations by Dr. Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Commission, I'm Rich Harris, Section Supervisor for Mountain Goats, Moots, Sheep, and even Pronghorn Antelope, but we won't talk about pronghorns today. I'm going to walk you through five different WACs. The first three have to do with hunting seasons for the three species, and then there are two additional ones that have to do with some of our management, particularly of bighorn sheep and mountain goats. So I'd like to begin with moose. First give you an overview. Moose have been increasing in Northeast Washington as a result of our own analysis as well as suggestions from the public. We took a good look at all of our harvest levels, decided that we could increase our harvest levels and provide some additional hunter opportunity. So I will run you through the numbers, but the overview is that we're proposing approximately 25% increase in permit levels for moose. Last year we had 136, of which 86 were what we call any moose, which is primarily bulls. Most people take bulls, but cows are legal. And 50 antlerless to 170, of which 107 would be of the any and 63 antlerless. To accomplish this, well, first let me show you some of the rationale, the analysis that went into this. We do have some preliminary indications on population size from work we are currently undertaking. We don't have any final numbers on that yet, but we do have indications that the numbers that have been existing on websites and in our previous publications of the number of moose in Washington is, if anything, on the low side. It's probably going to be higher than that. We do have analyses of population trend up through 2012, which continue to show increasing population trend. During the years 2004 to 2014, the graph on the left shows you the number of permits the department has issued, and the harvest number is the line below that. As you can see, there's been a somewhat of an upward trend, although not as dramatic as what we were proposing today. The days per hunt, so the catch per unit effort, how long it takes to get a hunt, to get a moose, has actually gone down during that time. It's not proof positive, but it's certainly suggestive that the population has been going up and things remain good for moose. The two districts we hunt moose in, District 1, District 2, both in Region 1. If you look at just the data from District 1, the age of moose killed by hunters, we don't get every single moose age, but more than half of them. And generally speaking, older moose age is indicative of a healthier situation. If the age is going down, that suggested that pressure has been increasing. But the average age of moose has actually been going up slightly over the past 10 years. So that's an additional indicator that things are in pretty good shape for moose, at least now. So to accomplish the increase, we are proposing some changes in our existing geography of moose harvest. On the left is the map of the existing moose units from our 2014 Big Game pamphlet, and on the right is a map showing the recommended changes. These changes are really minor. What we're basically doing is taking, in some cases we've had game management units aggregated into sort of super game management units for moose. Now we're going to de-aggregate them so that we can disperse harvest pressure a bit more finely. So the first change is 108, 111, which have been lumped together, now return to their constituent elements. So there'll be a separate 108 and a separate 111. We've had something called the Huckleberry Moose Unit, which actually includes the Huckleberry GMU and part of the GMU to its south. And we're now going to split those up into their constituent parts. And finally, we've had this one called Cheney. It's been called Hangman, excuse me, which has been a combination of Cheney and Micah Peak down south of Spokane. Now they return to their constituent units. So no new boundary making is required, simply a matter of disaggregating. So I'd run you quickly through the changes. We're proposing no change in approximately half of the units and increases in approximately the other half. no change in this one to the north. The reason we want to have some large areas with no change is as kind of a control. If we can keep these increased over a number of years and look at things such as the age of harvest, the catch per unit effort in harvest, and compare an area where we're keeping things the same as we've had them for the past few years versus an increase, we'll gain a little bit of knowledge of the effect of our increase. We've chosen not to increase in this area largely because this is where we have the weakest data in this northernmost area. Similarly, no change in the Selkirk 113. While there's no reason to believe that moose are doing poorly here, we have our weakest data here, so we've selected this also to be a control area and make it a no change. The Parker Lake, this is a new area you may remember from last year. This is a military-controlled area, very restricted hunt because of our agreement with the Air Force. They can only take a few hunters. This is two bow hunters and two muzzleloader hunters. Isn't room for any more there, so that obviously stays the same as well. And these areas around Mount Spokane, we're proposing no change because harvest is already fairly aggressive in these areas to reduce conflicts. This is also where we're doing our demographic study, which we started last year. And we'd like to, part of the rationale of the demographic study is to look at harvest rates. So rather than change harvest rates right in the middle of the study, we'd like to keep that the same down here as well. So these areas around Spokane are unchanged from the past few years. But where we are recommending increases in permit levels are in this Douglas 108 from a total of 3 to a total of 8. Aladdin to its east from a total of 3 to a total of 8. 49 degrees north from a total of 29 to 39. And in these areas, I should also mention that in order to provide various types of opportunity, we're proposing a split season. Nowadays, all of our moose seasons are 2 months long. I think that's the longest big game season we have in the state. We're proposing in some of these cases to have an October season and a November season separately that will distribute hunting pressure spatially, temporally, give people more opportunity to decide what kind of hunt they'd like to be involved in. It still gives a month, which, given our success rates are upwards of 90%, with 2 months, and most people get their moose in 4 or 5 days, we think that a month is probably sufficient to provide the kind of opportunity we'd like to. And then the Huckleberry unit, proposing going from a total of 7 permits to a total of 15. And this new Spokane, part of 124, Spokane West, has not had separate harvest. It's been part of the Huckleberry, so now it's going to be split off onto its own with 3 permits. And this Cheney, this has been in the past part of the Hangman, and almost all the harvest down here south of Spokane has occurred to the east up against the Idaho border, Mica Peak, but there are lots of moose in Cheney, just not a lot of public land, so we'll have a couple of cow permits in here to relieve some of the over-moosing, and we've got a lot of roadkill and that kind of stuff, and provide some opportunity in that area as well. For mountain goats, we have some small changes in seasons, but a couple of substantive changes in the way the rules go as well. We're proposing to the commission a mandatory in-person inspection for mountain goats. We have mandatory registration nowadays for bighorn sheep, but not for mountain goats. We are the only state hunting mountain goats that does not have mandatory registration. I'll show you just in just a minute why I think it's a good idea. I think the hunting community has been rather supportive of this, and we're talking about the 20 to 30 goats per year, so it's not a large workload for our staff. We're also, to skip to the third bullet here, we're also proposing to extend the season through November. This was a suggestion from the public. We polled our biologists to see if there would be any conflicts. Some hunters would like a longer season because the fur, the coat of a mountain goat becomes more attractive much later in the season as it gets colder. And in a couple of areas, goats come down to more accessible areas in later in the season than earlier. There was no indication of any conflicts. Again, our goat harvest is pretty close to 90% success, so we saw no conflicts with that, so we are proposing to adopt that suggestion from the public. And then the small revisions of our goats. First, let me explain why we want to go to mandatory registration. Goats are unique in that determining the sex in the field can be very difficult. I think you can tell real quick if you look at it quick, which is the males and females. I'm not going to tell you. But many of our hunters have difficulty too, and we really want them to shoot males and not females. Well, we also want to know, because we are now moving to a system in which we will base our harvests on the proportion of the harvest that's billies versus nannies. And that way we can provide opportunity while still safeguarding the resource. Well, right now we're depending on the hunters to tell us. We'd like to have them in hand. The other thing we can do when we have goat horns in hand is we can age them. We don't have to send teeth out for aging. We can save some money, but we can do it more accurately. We can get a lot of biological information, a lot just from the horns, if we have them in hand. As you know, goats are still way down in Washington relative to our estimates of historic levels, but the good news is there seems to be a general increase over the past few years. In 2008, Cliff Rice, who was then finishing up his research work on mountain goats in the state, tried to estimate how many goats there were statewide, and he divided up the entire goat range into a number of different blocks that he could identify and put his best guesstimate forward of how many there were in each. Some of these numbers came from rigorous surveys using peer-reviewed literature that he had devised on what we call citability estimates. In other cases, they were the best estimate available from ground estimates. I went back last year and revisited these numbers wherever I could. Whenever we had more recent survey information, I updated it. Where we had no recent information, I simply carried the old numbers forward. And this graph summarizes the difference of our estimates of how many goats there were in each of these areas in 2007 compared to 2014. In all but one, there's some indication of an increase. And these white bars are confidence intervals that give you some idea of how certain we are of these different numbers. I'm not sure we can take credit for this. It could be that we experienced some fortuitous years in terms of weather. But it's also quite possible that what we're seeing is the good results from the kind of conservative harvest that we've been employing for mountain goats over the past decade or so relative to the high, unsustainable kinds of goat harvests that we used to have in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So it's good news, but it doesn't necessarily mean that every single one of our goat areas is doing well. We still have to look at each of our defined goat areas individually, and this map shows you all the places where we currently hunt goats. You'll notice that there were a lot of those areas that I just showed in the previous graph that are not on this one, and oftentimes it's because we haven't been able to identify a single population of 100 or more goats, which is what we consider to be the minimum that we want to be harvesting. Goats, as you know, are very sensitive to over-harvest, so we have to do this very carefully. So Mount Baker has our largest population of goats, and within the Mount Baker we have these subunits, and I'll quickly go through. And you can see these are all small numbers. They look like they're very minor tweaks, and they are, but from the perspective of goat harvest, they're actually somewhat consequential. So we're because of population increases that we've documented, increasing from 2 to 3, next door in Lincoln Peak from 1 to 2, and Chowder Ridge, 1 permit. These are only places where we're changing. Now, in the Region 3 area between not too far out of Cleellum and Ellensburg, Bumping River area, from 2 permits to 3, based on population increases. Surveys show we can increase from 2 to 3 in Natchez Pass as well. Blazed Ridge near Highway 410, that population has a little bit less than 100, so we're below our threshold that we've identified in the game management plan, so we have to suspend that permit, at least until surveys show we're back up above that. Goat Rocks is our second largest goat population out of Packwood, and that's been gradually increasing, so we're proposing to increase to 5 permits there. Last year, you may recall, we began a new kind of goat harvest on the Olympic Peninsula, different from our other goat hunting opportunities. This is not intended to be a low, conservative, sustained yield hunt. This is actually a conflict reduction hunt. A lot of hikers up there. We've got problem goats. Olympic National Park is engaging in a process that we are cooperatives in that is likely to result in a proposal to reduce or perhaps eliminate goats in the park. We're right up against the park there. So we had a couple of hunts there this past year. We're going to continue that. We propose to change the boundaries, though, to give the hunters a bit more flexibility. So we're simply taking these two units and combining them into one larger unit with the same aggregate number of permits. The other new thing on the horizon for goats is this new unit that we haven't had goat hunting in this part of the North Cascades for many years. This is near the town of Darrington. We're calling this the Boulder River North. We began surveying this area 3 years ago, concerned that we had very few goats. Historically, this has been an area that has been known for, in the past, having lots, but very few recently, we started, to our surprise, we were pleasantly surprised to find out that there were more goats than we thought. So subsequent surveys we did in 2013, 2012, indeed told us that we were above the threshold we needed to be according to the game management plan that we were directed to begin providing for hunter opportunity here as well. Our guidelines say that we need to have at least 100 mountain goats that we've actually surveyed older than kid, so juvenile and above. Our best estimate is that we've got 111. And we could actually propose more permits than this. We thought we would start conservatively. The Forest Service would like us to start conservatively as well. We've met with them. We've now met with the relevant Indian tribes in this area as well. So for now, we're proposing that we begin with only a single permit, and we'll see how this goes. For bighorn sheep, all of these are minor tweaks to our existing permit levels. As you may know, bighorn sheep in our state are still facing a kind of a rocky road. Many of our sheep herds are afflicted with pneumonia. They don't come out of it very well. We have a number of other issues. All of our sheep herds are small. They're all vulnerable. We try to provide the hunting opportunity when we can, but in some cases we've had to cut back, and you'll see some reductions here due to smaller population size. The Asotin population is afflicted with pneumonia. There's been a number of additional deaths. A number of animals got into trouble, had to be removed. When they get into town and get close to domestic animals, we have to remove them. So we're proposing that we have to suspend the permit for this year in the Asotin population. The Umtanum population between Ellensburg and Yakima has also got pneumonia. That population will start to reduce. We'll be seeing a reduction in that population size, but we're going to reduce that from 3 to 2 ram tags to make sure hunters can find decent rams. The Clement population is doing well, but because of previous experience with using it as stock for translocation, it had gotten way out of balance used to rams, and so we were actually taking more rams short-term than we wanted to long-term. We're now getting back into balance, and so returning to more the normal level of ram offtake from that population. The Quillamine is another population that is down, so we're having to reduce from 3 to 2 permits. This population, unfortunately, has declined. Mount Hull population is doing well, but we had all of the auction and raffle hunters take their rams from this population last year, and we need to give it a bit of a break, so we're going to reduce this down to 1 permit for this year. Probably in future we can get that back up again. One thing that's a bit new, this Chelan Butte population is one of our more accessible populations. It's the newest reintroduced population in the state, and there are still some animals wearing radio collars that are no longer functioning and ear tags that were part of the initial translocation from 10, 11 years ago. They're getting old. We don't think they're part of the reproductive segment of the population anymore. But particularly in the case of the rams, they're not very large. And so hunters, but we have normal hunters in there, of course, they're usually interested in taking the largest animal they can. The ram is probably just going to die a natural death. And we've got lots of demand for providing hunter opportunity when we can. This is one of the few places where we thought we could offer a disabled hunter opportunity because you can get up there in a vehicle. So this is proposed as a situation in which we will actually direct hunters to specific animals that they would be allowed to take and not others. And there's been a fair amount of support from that, from the hunting community, since this is not too often that we can legitimately offer disabled permit for something as difficult to access as bighorns. So now I would like to talk a little bit about WAC 232-12-284, which is a permanent WAC dealing with marking. And to give you a bit of background, all the states and provinces that have bighorns are part of this permanent marking program. When you harvest a bighorn sheep, you bring it in. We do have mandatory registration. And this is a couple of slides showing what we do. We put this pin in it that's numbered, and then we keep a record of that number in our databases. And that legitimizes the hunts, lets the hunter know that everything is on the up and up, and it allows us to track this. And the reason we do this is that, in addition to being of great interest to hunters who like to put them up on their walls, these are also valuable. They can fetch thousands of dollars on the black market, and so can be an incentive for poaching. By having these things marked and keeping a clear records, we can distinguish between the legally harvested ones and anything that might be poached, and that way assist our law enforcement folks in knowing the difference. We discovered a year or two ago that the existing WAC had some ambiguities in it. So what we are proposing today consists largely of clarification of ambiguities. There has been some misunderstanding among some members of the public that we are actually proposing to make substantive changes in policy. I think what you would find is that really there is not a policy change involved here. There is clarification of language to make more concrete to both the public and to our staff exactly what we mean by what's in this WAC. So the first issue is that the definition of horns was found to be insufficient for our enforcement folks. It allowed for a loophole in which a single horn sheath did not actually count as a horn. And I think we had some instances where people who were probably really poaching were able to get off by saying, well, this isn't a horn, look at the whack. And as you'll know, if you've ever handled these things, the sheaths actually come right off of the skull fairly easily. And so to clarify that even a single horn, if we're looking at a poaching situation, a single horn could count as something that the enforcement officer could use as evidence. So that was the rationale behind this definition clarification, that it simply says that the horns do not have to be paired, and they may include one horn. They do not have to be attached to the skull. The second ambiguity has to do with what happens if somebody finds horns in the field or ahead, and can they bring them in? Can they keep them? Are they pinned? What's the rule? Well, we already have WAC 287 that specifies that it's illegal to possess dead wildlife except by permit. But it gives no guidance as to what situations would merit a permit. Similarly, because this situation seems to come under the issue of marking bighorns, it seems to get lumped in with the legal harvest, where the hunter is coming in a couple of days after the hunt, and they've got their permit, everything's clear. And so it left open the two interpretations. One is, well, no, you can't keep these. It requires a director's permit. Or the other interpretation is, here are my horns. May I please have my permit? And so this was causing distress among, uncertainty among the public, and a considerable uncertainty within the department as well. So we're proposing to clarify that what is meant here is the same as what's meant in 287, meaning illegal to possess dead wildlife. So we're proposing that this language be added, that it is unlawful to possess horns of a bighorn sheep originating in Washington, except as described in subsections 2, which is bringing in hunted legal horns and having them pinned and everything's fine, or section 4, which I'll get to in a minute, which deals with other circumstances in which one could find having horns. Finally, there's ambiguity about situations under which you'd be allowed to sell horns that you have. So again, we have WAC 071 that prohibits commerce without a permit. But again, without specific guidance about what situations the director ought to be able to provide a permit. But if you look at 071, bighorn sheep horns are lumped with things like bear gallbladders and velvet antlers. It seems clear that the intent is that we want to not be promoting commerce, profit-making, in selling animals, items that are valuable, that conceivably can have value to poachers, but that we want to provide legitimate opportunity for legal hunts and for those legal hunters to have these. So we are proposing language that clarifies this within 284 that says that permits will only be granted where such sale, purchase, or barter will specifically benefit bighorn sheep conservation or management. And as a side note to this, we do get horns usually from roadkill or disease-killed animals that we keep as a department. We provide these to some hunter advocacy organizations who enter into a contract with us to sell these, and then the proceeds come back to our bighorn management and conservation. And when they're sold with a specific permit from the director that says these are for your private use. You may display them, but you may not sell them again. So the sale is a one-time for conservation purposes. In working through all these complications, we discovered that there was yet another issue that we hadn't fully addressed that we propose addressing now, and that's why I'm bringing to you a floor change, which I'll I'll read to you, and I think you may have a copy of it. If not, we can get it to you. And that was the issue of what happens when Grandpa leaves an old bighorn mount that predates the era of permanent marking. Because we've only started, the states and provinces have been marking for a couple of decades, but some of this isn't marked. Well, that could be one of two things. It could be a perfectly legally obtained animal that simply was never marked because that system wasn't in existence, or it could be a poached animal, which obviously is not going to be marked. And enforcement has a difficult time figuring this out, and yet we don't want to penalize people who have something that's absolutely legitimate. No doubt the vast majority of these that are sitting in people's dens and garages were legally taken, and yet we want to maintain the clarity that the enforcement requires to be able to identify those that were actually poached and to make sure that they have the tools that they need. So we're proposing this floor change, and if I may, I would read to you the proposed new language, which is in subsection 4, clause 4 of WAC 12-284, and I would begin with the third sentence after that begins, it is unlawful. So after the sentence that I just read, actually, about that permits for sale would be granted where specifically benefiting conservation or management, then the new language would read, it is unlawful for any person who transfers ownership or possession of the horns of a bighorn sheep ram that have been permanently marked to fail to give written notice of the transfer to the department within 30 days after the transfer. And that 30 is new. It currently reads 10. So we would provide more time for people with these to provide notice that they have transferred ownership so we can continue to track them in our database system. And then the new sentence, in the case of horns originating from a bighorn sheep legally obtained prior to the initiation of permanent marking in the jurisdiction of its origin, the director is authorized to issue a permit for possession but not resale. Such a permit must subsequently be retained with the horns. After such a permit is issued, the horns must be presented for permanent marking to a DFW office within 30 days. So in this way, someone who has a grandfather legacy set of horns who may wish to then transfer them to another family member or a friend could simply say, look, here's my evidence that these were indeed legally taken here years ago or somewhere else. And then we could consider that. And in most cases, we would find that, in fact, there's no reason to suspect any kind of illegal activity. We would issue a permit specifying the conditions, and then they would have them pinned. Then those horns would join the system. They would be tracked just as all the other legal horns. But in the unusual situation in which there was some reason to really suspect that something fishy was going on, we'd have the ability to say, hang on a second, maybe this is not the case. And this would allow our enforcement officers to nab the people that they're interested in nabbing while still providing a way for these old legacy horns to join the system and be legal. Two of the things I would add on this WAC. One is that, go ahead.
Sure, hold still.
Sorry.
Thank you, Chair Smith. On this deal. Is this a solution looking for a problem, or is it that big a problem? And granted, we're dealing with bighorn sheep, but this kind of stuff starts a slippery slope in my world, because I've got elk horns around my place that are 100 years old that there's no dang way on earth I could ever prove what was going on. And there again, if it's a big issue, yeah, I can see addressing it. But is it a big issue?
It's an issue. Whether it's big or not probably depends on your viewpoint. These are by far the most valuable horn type things that we have. We do have poaching. We have current investigations going on. Most of these changes were suggested by specific enforcement officers who are having difficulty prosecuting folks who they're pretty sure are poachers. To your question of is this a slippery slope, I don't think it is. If you look at the totality of the WAC, shed antlers are specifically exempt from the prohibition.
I know sheds are, but I've got attached sets that are approaching 100 years old in my garage that definitely have some value to them because of their size. There again, isn't with all the DNA testing and genetic testing, can't you tell if there's some age on the horns or not?
No, you can't use DNA to tell age. Again, I would point out that we've had this pinning program in the state. Every state
right.
that has bighorns has pinning. We don't pin any other species. The bighorns really do live in a somewhat different world because of the concern about poaching, because of their small population size. So I think we are strengthening a system that we already have. I don't see any real change in what we're doing except clarifying what's already there but vague because of the vagueness of saying a director may issue a permit or may not. So I understand your concern. I don't think there's a slippery slope, and there's certainly no intention to penalize legal hunters, nor do I think that that would occur with these changes. I would point out a couple of other things about this. One is that in the run-up to working on these changes, I brought these issues to the Wild Sheep Working Group of the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, WAFWA, and I was asked by that group to put together a survey of all the states and provinces of how they deal with this issue. And I've done that. That's on the WAFWA website, but it may not be too easy. We're certainly happy to help to provide you with a summary of all that. I was surprised to find more variety in how states and provinces deal with this than we found. I thought that there'd be more consistency. It's kind of all over the board. But slightly more than half the states do not allow possession of picked up horns. Very few of the states allow sale of these horns for that same reason.
I guess I'm headed with it is just some old trophy that's been in on the wall for umpteen hundred years. And, you know, there again, we're all sitting here now, we know this law. But if it's been in your den for 40 years, all of a sudden you're running along fat, dumb, and happy, and you give it to the grandkid or whatever, now you're making him an outlaw. I can see your point and understand that, because we've had quite a few sheep die-offs in our area, and, yeah, you don't keep them. And it's an issue, but... when you get going back on these older heads, that does concern me a little.
Well, again, I don't think there's actually a change being suggested here. What we're changing in our proposed floor change is a way for people to essentially validate something that they're already claiming, and for the department to go on record as saying, yeah, we've recognized these as legal. Where it comes up is when people want to transfer these. And so... If there's a transfer, there's always the chance that somebody's doing something nefarious. We'd like to be able to provide our enforcement a way to distinguish that, and I think this offers a way for people to say, hey, wait a minute, I can show you that these are fine, and we can permit that and pin those animals.
And I understand where you're going with this, but who is going to have Grandpa's hunt license tag from 40 years ago?
Well... By the wording in this floor change, we are not making specific requirements of the kind of evidence that would be required. It's a director discretion. And so I think this is a way that we can provide permits in the vast majority of cases in which there's really no reason to suspect nefarious activity, but still allow our enforcement the latitude that they are requiring, because they live in a very black and white legal world. People can get off. Right now, if somebody actually did poach an animal and they say, no, I got these from my grandpa, this was from before the days of pinning, the enforcement officer has no recourse.
And don't get me wrong, I'm thoroughly in favor of people poaching, getting caught, and nailed to the cross. Do not get me wrong. But I just hate laws where you can take somebody and make them illegal without their knowledge of it and without any ill intentions. Thank you.
Are we taking?
Yeah, continue on.
Let me move on to the last whack that we're requesting some changes on, and that has to do with the raffles and auctions, not for all the species. I'm just going to deal with the two of them, mountain goats and California bighorn sheep. As it is now, we have one auction and one raffle for mountain goats. For California bighorn sheep, we have a statewide auction, a statewide raffle, but they're also available under two of the multi-species raffles. The South Central and North Central. So the current regulation under WAC 284, I'm sorry, I think this is the wrong number, it's the Raffles and Auctions WAC, says that if we can provide two or more regular draw permits, then that unit will be open to the auction and raffle people. if we can provide only one, then that will not be available. And the rationale, I think, for this made some sense in that it ensures that the herd is large and it provides some predictability. You can see if it's a two or more, then that will be available to the auction winner and the raffle winner. The problem has come up that by linking these two kinds of hunts together, the biologist now faces a situation in which, let's suppose they have a herd that is large enough for just one draw permit, and it has now grown to the point where two might be appropriate, or perhaps even three. If they go to two, they run the probability that they'll have their two draw permits, and they might also have the statewide auction hunter, they might also have the statewide raffle winner, and they might also have one of the multi-species, because all those multi-species people are shooting bighorns. So from one, they suddenly could be going to five. And they have no way to micromanage, and our biologists do micromanage these pretty successfully, to say, I would like to have two or I would like to have three. There's no way to completely solve this problem, but we are proposing that within the department we have ways to make up the difference and to come onto a kind of a glide path where we don't have to go from one to suddenly, oops, we've got five, as we did this past year in the Hall Mountain herd, which means we have to go back to one again, which is actually what we're proposing this year. We have ways to be able to say, let's have just two, let's have three. We think the benefit of this is that we'll actually end up opening more of these sheep herds to the raffle and auction winners, because right now we have some overly conservative permit provision for the draw owners because of the concern that when we go to two, suddenly we could have five. We're going to have a fire sale. So we're asking for the commission to authorize essentially director flexibility, where the department will commit to advertising which herds will be available for the auction and raffle people by January. The reason we need to have it in January, way 9 months ahead of the hunting season, is because the organizations that do these auctions and raffles, they usually meet in January, February. Those hunters need to be knowing what they're bidding for way in advance. So we can actually know sooner than we currently know which of these herds will be available to the auction and raffle winner. So it has the benefits of the disadvantages. I'll have to come to you every year and tell you which ones we want to do, but the advantages, we can smooth out these kind of bumps in the number of rams taken in these small herds and provide additional for advertisement ahead of time to the hunting community.
Thank you, Rich.
Additional questions?
Questions? There. Oh. We do have three public that wish to come up. I'll call the first two, Freddie G. and Al Martz, please. Again, 3 minutes, the beeper will go off.
As the proposals are, the increase in the permits isn't an issue, given with the wolf problems, cougars and bears.
It's on now.
Okay. Anyhow, we don't have a problem with the increase in the permits, but given that there's 9 areas for any moose, which means a once-in-a-lifetime permit, the splitting of the seasons takes away hunter opportunity for the gentleman or lady that wants to go out and harvest a big moose and wants to have that opportunity for that once-in-a-lifetime hunt. Splitting the units is of no concern. It does allow a little bit more opportunity. All the areas south will still remain a month or 2 month long season. It just seems inequitable to penalize certain people for hunting a certain area and only allow them a month of hunting rather than the 60 days, while allowing other people to have 60 days to hunt on a once in a lifetime permit.
Thank you. And Gary Dubier, please.
Chairman, Commissioners, Mr. Unsworth. Freddie pretty well just stole my thunder. I think he had the same notes that I have here. I asked several people within the department why they were splitting the moose season there, and I got no clear answer. One was to study, but they weren't quite sure what the study was going to be. Another one was success ratios. And like Freddie says, not all of these units are split. The ones up north are split. One in the far east is split. And the southern units all around the Spokane area are not split. So they have a two-month season. The success ratio is around 95%, so there's nothing to improve here. As far as hunting pressure, up north in Aladdin there, I don't know when it got changed, but it was 6 permits. Now I see that it's 8, but that equals out to about 45 square miles per hunter. So this hunting pressure is not an issue at all. In 117, 49 degrees north there, it's about 500 square miles. I don't think 30 moose hunters in there is a hunting pressure problem. If there's a pressure problem, it's with the 3,000 deer and elk hunters. It's not the additional 15 moose hunters. And there again, as Freddie mentioned, this is a once-in-a-lifetime tag, and I think persons should have every opportunity to hunt as long as possible there. You hunt early, you might want to hunt during the rut. You hunt late, you can hunt during the snow, so you can do both of those. And there again, the fairness issue. Two-month season down south, one-month season up north. Not fair. I don't think this is very well thought out. There's no real good reasoning behind it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Smith. To be brief, this has happened to remind me, and particularly with our new director, a number of years ago, Chuck Perry and Miranda Wecker and myself attended WAFLA meeting in Montana to talk about wolf preparation with those other states. And we met with the Idaho game management team, and they made a bet with us that the moose would be the first ungulate that would be destroyed. And talking with our enforcement people and our conflict specialists in Northeast Washington, they're finding very few, if any, scat from wolves that doesn't have moose hair in it. This last year, we had a difficult time surveying moose because of the weather situation. So we do have a very healthy, successful moose program, and we're something we should really be proud of. I don't think we're really sure we know how they're doing right now relative to the wolf and predators on their calving situation. So I'm nervous about increasing permits right now. At the same time, the wolf packs are growing exponentially. And splitting the season, I have several friends that got one of these drawings, and they spent 39 to 59 days hunting. And they shot usually one on the last day because they were so selective and knew that this was once in a lifetime thing. So there is that group of hunters that if they do get drawn, they start in the summer trying to scout, and then they spend tracking and trying to find the one moose that they can get to harvest. So I don't, and there isn't a crowding problem. We put 30 people in some of these GMUs. You could give them GPSs so they couldn't find each other. So I think it's just nervous. I think we want to make double sure that we're ready to increase that many moose permits. I think it's healthy. I'd rather see us shoot them than the wolves eat them. But I would also like to see them last. So I also would kind of like to ask the director with his experience in Idaho what has happened to their moose population.
But in central Idaho, moose populations took a big hit and actually disappeared, and several hunts were closed in the Frank Church and some of the wilderness country. They were never very high or very what I would call good moose habitat like it is up north. And up north, they've held pretty good. I think that Idaho increased some permits in the panhandle this year, but I would need to double check that. I can't recall.
I think if we are real cautious about which GMUs we open this up to is very important. look at the, what kind of predator situation we have there. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Gary. And that closes.